Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Steve Maxwell Drums Podcast. Don't forget to check us out on our website at www.maxwelldrums.com and then our reverb stores at Steve Maxwell Drums-Chicago and Steve Maxwell Drums-New York. We also have social media, two Instagram accounts, at Maxwell Drum Shop Chicagoland and then at Maxwell Drum Shop. And then also on Facebook, Steve Maxwell and Steve Maxwell Drum Shop. And then, of course, check us out on Twitter, at Maxwell Drum Shop. We're going to be interviewing musicians from all over, Chicago, New York, Nashville, and then drum builders. We're going to be talking about all kinds of different subjects drum related. So we're going to have lots of fun. And if you want to check it out, you can go to Podbean or Apple Podcast or Spotify. And you can go to YouTube if you want to see the video. We'll have pictures of drum shops, of drum sets, badges, cymbals, all kinds of fun stuff. So let's get started. We hope you enjoy it. 3, 2, 1. So, hey again, Dad, how you doing?
I am good, very good.
All right, so this is the third installment of our Maxwell Drums podcast, and today we're going to be talking about the vintage American drum companies.
Yeah, basically at a broad level. Eventually, we'll talk about them individually because there's so much content to cover on each one, but right now, we'll talk about what I consider, I'll steal a line from my friend Harry Kangany's book, The Great American Drum Companies. And we'll talk about those companies on a broad basis overall. And these are the companies that were making drums in this country from, you know, the beginning of the 1900s through, we'll call it the 1970s. We'll kind of cut it there. And we'll talk broadly about the major companies.
All right, great. Yeah, I know a lot of these drum companies. I mean, the drum set is pretty much the pinnacle instrument that was invented in the United States. Before the United States, you didn't have a drum set, and all the different parts just kind of came together from all the different influences, and that's a really cool thing. So I think that's the reason that you see all these early American drum companies being the you know, the ones that were the innovators in basically every field. So I guess we can start with the Ludwig Drum Company.
Yeah, and there are there's a certain lineage here because there were three primary companies in the 1900s, early 1900s, and those were Ludwig, Slingerland, and Leedy. But for right now, we're going to talk about Ludwig generally. Ludwig was founded by William F. Ludwig Sr. and his brother, Theobald, and it was a very, very innovative business. They designed a lot of great products, and keep in mind, when drum sets were first on the market in the 1900s, you basically just had a snare drum, a bass drum, and then what we refer to as traps, which would have been things like Oriental temple blocks. Ride cymbals didn't exist then. Cymbals were only used for accents, so they would be small, maybe 8-inch or 10-inch splash cymbals. There would be cowbells, things like that. But the basic drum set, there was no hi-hat at that point in time, was a snare drum, a bass drum, and these miscellaneous traps.
And back then, a lot of people made their living playing in things that we don't have anymore, like silent movies.
Oh, yeah. I mean, people were playing in pit orchestras that provided the music for silent films.
You had like an organist and then a drummer making, you know, the sound of the horse.
Yeah, and you had many other things, exactly. Horse's hooves for, you know, horse galloping. You had all those traps to create those sounds. So all that being said, in the beginning, you had basically a very fundamental basic snare drum, usually bass drum, basically a 28-inch bass drum back then, and a variety of snare drums. Ludwig was very innovative. They made an incredible drum, which we refer to as the Black Beauty, but it was a heavy brass two-piece shell that they started making in the early 1900s. And again, we're not going to spend a huge amount of time on each individual company, just a couple of highlights. That Black Beauty, whether it was called Black Beauty because it was black over a brass shell, and then there was engraving on the shell so that the engraving pattern showed through with the brass underneath. It was beautiful. But you could also buy that drum unengraved with nickel over brass, and it was the same shell. Those shells are still sought after today, those drums from the early 1900s, especially the 20s into the 30s. Those heavy brass shell snare drums are hit makers today. They still are highly in demand. Ludwig went on, when drum sets migrated to actually having toms and bass drums and snares, the toms were basically added thanks to Gene Krupa. So that was the first iteration. You're starting to talk about in the 30s when drum sets started to evolve to the traditional four-piece kit, a rack tom, which they used to call a mounted tom, a floor tom, a bass drum, and a snare drum. Ludwig was very innovative there. They had their three-ply mahogany poplar mahogany shells with rounded edges. Later on, as they migrated through the 50s into the later 60s, you had maple poplar maple with a rounded edge. Into the 70s, you had six-ply maple with a 45 edge. And these were all designed at different points in time to adapt to the music at that time.
Back to the origins of Ludwig. I read once that a part of the reason the company started was because of those metal snare drums. And there was a drum which was played on George Philip Sousa, I think. And then that was actually a sonar drum.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, he went to Leedy, and Ludwig wanted Leedy to make a metal snare drum. That was his idea. And Leedy was like, no, we're not going to do that. Well, but then that's part of the reason he started his own company. And
so yeah, Ludwig was very, very inspired by, I believe it was, I'd have to go back and look up, I think it was the Tom Mills drum, a metal drum, early sonar metal drum.
Yeah, it was like
German
a brass drum.
Yeah, wonderful instrument, and it inspired Ludwig. And Ludwig was very innovative in that they also designed their bass drum pedal. The bass drum pedal that they used was an innovative design. The snare drums were great sounding drums, very innovative. So they did a lot of great work. And the company stayed within the family for many years. William F. Ludwig Sr., when he passed away, William F. Ludwig Jr. kept the company that was eventually sold. I'd have to look at the numbers. Sometime, I think, it was the 80s, but I can't remember exactly when.
So of the Ludwig metal drums, like can you name like your favorite each decade, maybe starting in like the 20s?
Yeah, that's a good question. In the 20s era, any of the heavy brass shell drums, it doesn't have to be the engraved Black Beauty, because that was just...
Yeah, a really nice one is the Ludwig Super, which is later they call it the Super Sensitive, but you can get those in like a just nickel finish, and they're really awesome drums.
Yeah, the Ludwig Super, there were three
or
models.
Super Ludwig.
There was a standard, which was like your normal snare throw-off with your normal snare wires on the bottom, nothing fancy. And those are great drums. Those are actually my favorite. The next, they had the Ludwig Super, which was the extended strainer. So it would take the snares all the way across the head and beyond the head on both sides with a parallel release. When that was reintroduced in the 60s, they called that a Super Sensitive. But in the 20s, when that was introduced, it was called the Super. The third model in the 20s was an actual Super Sensitive. And that drum was the Ludwig Super with the extended snares, with one other feature. Under the top head was a separate set of snare wires that you could move on or off. And they were designed to provide extra sensitivity, hence the name Super Sensitive, extra sensitivity at low volumes or with brushes or things like that. It was not designed to be played on hard with those snares on because you'd break them. They're sitting right up under the top head. But you'd turn those off, you could play the drum regularly. Turn those on, and you could get extra sensitivity off the top head.
And that was one of those things that kind of never really went anywhere because it maybe doesn't sound all that great with those.
Yeah, well, it sounds, it just depends on how you use it. If you use it for light, subtle passages, it works great, and then you have to turn it off. And then you have to be careful of the wires. Ludwig also made, in the 20s and 30s, they made, and into the 40s, a very nice one-piece maple. So they had solid steam-bent maple shells for their snare drums. Not all, but they made some with solid maple, and those were great. So I'm a big fan of those.
And then, so later on, probably the most popular snare drum of all ever is this Ludwig Supra. I mean, would you agree with me? I mean, that's probably the most played, most recorded.
Yeah, the Supraphonic 400, you start moving through, now you get to, you know, right around 1960.
That's a
You're
lighter
talking
show.
About the Supraphonic 400, and that was basically, there were original versions of that with a brass shell for a couple of years, but the basic Supraphonic 400 is an aluminum-based shell, alloy shell, chrome-plated, 10 lugs, and it's a workhorse drum, and it's been used countless times on recordings forever and ever. So if you think about it, and then we'll move on to the next company so we don't take too long, but the heavy brass shell drums in the 20s, I really liked those. I really liked the solid shell snares that they made, you know, later 30s through the 40s. And I really liked the Supraphonic 400. It's a great drum.
And again, yeah, not to take too long, but I think if we're talking about Ludwig, we should definitely touch on the WFL era.
Well, yeah.
And that, what you know, that whole story.
Yeah, there was a period of time when, thanks to the Depression, Bill Ludwig sold his business to Kahn, C.G. Kahn. And then he wanted to get back in business himself, but he was not able to use his own name. So you had a period of time in there when Ludwig drums, as I refer to them, were basically a period of time there, they were listed as WFL, because he could only use his initials. He couldn't use his proper last name because he had sold that to C.G. Kahn.
Really good drums, though.
50s era drums, wonderful stuff.
Mahogany poplar
shells, yep.
And brass triple flange.
Yes, the brass hoops were great, triple flange brass hoops. Great stuff, great drums. And then in the late 50s, C.G. Kahn had gotten to own Ludwig, and they had also gotten to own Leedy, which we haven't talked about yet. In the late 50s, C.G. Kahn sold Leedy to Slingerland, and Ludwig bought back his name. So in the late 50s, you started to have Ludwig with what they call a transition badge that no longer said WFL. It now said Ludwig, and it was like a blue and gold badge. And then eventually they went to their Keystone badge with
Ludwig. Then for anyone who's curious, if you see something that says Leedy and Ludwig, that's when it was owned by Kahn.
That's right.
And they put the names together for a short period of time.
That's right. That's exactly right.
So now we're going to move on to Slingerland. Slingerland is another great American manufacturer. And actually, I know a lot about the origins of Slingerland. When they first started, I know that they started in a place, I believe on Ashland Avenue, and they were teaching lessons, and their business started like way early on, before they even made drums. They made, I believe it was ukuleles.
Slingerland Banjo and Drum
Banjo.
Company.
Right,
that was a big deal. They made banjos.
And they did this really cool idea where you would have lessons with them, and then be able to play on their instrument, and through the lessons, you'd pay off your instrument, which is kind of a cool idea.
Yeah.
You know, it was like an installment, you know, each lesson.
Piece of that went toward your instrument.
That was the very beginning, but then we'll skip a little bit ahead to when they started making drums.
Well, Slingerland was very innovative. Not quite as innovative, perhaps, as Ludwig in the early 1900s, but Slingerland made great drums. Again, they also had some solid shell wood snares. They also had a heavy shell Black Beauty. The Slingerland drum was actually called the Black Beauty. The Ludwig drum was never cataloged as the Black Beauty. It was the standard or the super or the super sensitive, but Slingerland cataloged it as Black Beauty, and they made it for a couple of years, 28, 29. They're exceedingly rare. Very few were made.
There's maybe 14, 15.
Yeah. I've owned a few. Three, I think I've only.
If you ever made it down to the Naperville shop like 4 years ago, you might have been able to see the one we had.
Yeah, they're very expensive, but they're collector pieces. But they're very interesting. But Slingerland, you have to give Slingerland some credit. Slingerland really started coming to prominence when Gene Krupa started playing. Krupa, for those who don't know, Krupa was the man who really brought the drum set to the forefront of the orchestra. He was a great showman. He was a great player. He didn't have the technical facility of somebody like Buddy Rich or Louis Belson, but Gene was a great showman. He was a good-looking guy. He was really active behind the kit. He was really exciting in his playing. He had a great band. He always had great vocalists in his band. And Gene was the person who wanted, instead of what they used to have on these early drum sets I talked about, where they had these little different traps, they also had, the only thing they had for toms was something called a Chinese tack bottom tom.
No tunable.
Yeah.
I'm sure
they were just tack top and bottom
one of those before,
for a while. It was just, you know, just a little thing about this big, with a hide head that was all tacked on top and tacked on the bottom, and that's what you had. A little bit later on, Krupa started wanting drums that you could tune, toms that you could tune. So he was instrumental in getting Slingerland to create tom-toms for a drum set. And that's where the traditional drum set started to come about in that Gene Krupa era. First, in some cases, with drums that were only tuned at the top. And the bottom was still that raw calf head, but the top was tunable. And then eventually it was tunable both sides.
And if everybody looks, there's actually a drum right back there, which
is
right in between the eras. And what I'll do is I'll include a picture of it.
That one happens to be a Ludwig kit from the same era, but same stuff.
The bass drum that's lighting up, it's part of that kit.
Yeah.
Those are original lights, by the way, in there that are probably 80 years old. They still work.
And the lights served a purpose back then. The lights were there to, the heads were hide. We're getting a little off the topic, but it's worth it.
That's a Ludwig
kit. The heads were hide. And so if you went into a venue that was very humid, because there was no air conditioning back then, those heads would get very loose because they're natural hide. If you went and you had to play in an outside venue in cool weather, they'd get very, very tight. So the idea behind the light inside the bass drum, literally, it's a light bulb. You plug it into the wall, and it would create enough heat to then make the drum...
Yeah, kind of dry it out.
Dry it out a little bit and make it more playable. But, Slingerland really, really came to prominence during that era with Gene Krupa. And when you think about the two, I'll call them the two leading drum companies working through in well into the 60s, you had Ludwig and Slingerland really pushing the way there. Not that there weren't other fine companies, which there were, but Ludwig had the benefit, once it hit the 60s, of Ringo and the Beatles to help jumpstart sales. Slingerland had had the benefit of Gene Krupa through the 40s and the 50s, and then they also had Buddy Rich and Louie Bellson in the 60s, so they were still doing very, very well.
Yeah.
So if you look at those two were the, neck and neck, head to head
in the same
companies.
City.
In the same city.
And if I'm not mistaken, I believe B3, Bill Ludwig, the third, he lives in Chicago now. And I think the Slingerland family lives there as well.
Could be,
and
they
still live in the same city. And
now
the competition is all gone.
Yeah.
The companies aren't in Chicago anymore. But that was that was one heck of a rivalry.
Yeah. those were the two, the two most dominant brands. And when you think in terms of sales and market recognition during that era, we should move on. Probably talk about the next one.
So, this company is. I'd probably say it's like the first great American drum company. First of the real, real big ones.
It's
precedes both Slingerland and Ludwig.
Yeah, it does, but it's basically Ludwig, Slingerland, and then I decided to talk about Leedy next. Ludwig and Slingerland, because they were the most, I'll say they were, all three were extremely innovative. Leedy was extremely innovative, but Ludwig and Slingerland had staying power, and Leedy did not.
Yeah, they were kind of,
which
they
I'll
didn't
explain.
Change with the times.
I'll explain a little bit. Leedy really came to prominence under George Way.
In Indianapolis.
Indianapolis,
where they started.
Yeah. And George Way was a very brilliant innovator. He was very, very good at creating products that drummers needed. He did what he called a floating head, which is simply just the shell is slightly undersized, so that the head sits and floats a little bit, so sonically it sounds a little purer. And if you think about it, like a timpani. If you think of a timpani, the edge is here, but the head extends out, and that's why you get purer.
Side
in your
note
tone.
On this, to all you vintage enthusiasts out there, if you've ever noticed, how sometimes it's really difficult to get a head on a Gretsch drum.
Yeah.
If you notice, that almost never happens with Leedy drums.
That's right.
I think that's because they're just slightly undersized. And if
they
I'm
are.
Not
and
mistaken,
the Gretsch slightly,
all drums are like that now.
And the Gretsch were slightly oversized, which made it even worse. Because then once you put the wraps, and when you, White Marine Pearl wrap or whatever, those wraps are fairly thick. When you had calf heads and flesh hoops, you could get the heads on. But in the day of modern heads, it was a little tougher because the shell
was
too thick.
We'll talk more about
Gretsch
later,
but
Leedy, cool.
Was very innovative.
Still playable drums.
Yeah, George Way had some wonderful designs. Their metal shell drums are tremendous. They also did solid shell snare drums, and even early on, they did some solid shell bass drums. This is back in the day when it was just a snare drum and bass drum for a kit. So Leedy was extremely innovative. There's some great products. They still sound good today. The trouble with Leedy... The trouble is that George Way probably wasn't, he was a great inventor, but probably not the best businessman. So at the end of the day, long story short, Leedy went out of business, and basically George Way tried to start up another business, which was called George Way Drums. So we'll just kind of segue into that because it's so directly related to Leedy. And so George tried to make his own drums under the brand name George Way. And he designed a lug that everybody has seen 19 million times to Sunday and didn't realize where it came from. And that is today's DW lug. And I'll explain how this all works. The lineage here is, I won't spend a lot of time, but I'll explain it.
Although aristocrat or turret lug, that's the other two names for
Leedy
it.
Had two different types of lugs. George Way, two different types of lugs. One was, they call the aristocrat lug, which basically, just think DW drum lug, and you know what you're talking about. The other was a tuxedo lug, which was basically an elongated lug, like a snare drum lug, that was used for center mounting on drums to make a lower price point line. But on the George Way line, once again, great drums, wonderful shells, but again, not the most savvy business person. So at the end of the day, George lost his business to Camco Tool and Die, who did work for him.
Yeah, they made his parts, and he owed him a lot of money.
Exactly. So Camco took over that business. And in my personal opinion, some of the best jazz drums that were ever made were the Camco drums that came out of Oak Lawn, Illinois. But those can't be attributable to Camco. Those have to be attributable to George Way, because Camco basically got into the drum business because they took over George Way. But they were a tool and die company. So the credit for those great sounding Camco drums has to be given to George Way.
Yeah, he was quite the innovator.
Yes. And the Camco line lasted for into the 70s. Camco went from Oak Lawn to Chanute, Kansas, and eventually to L.A. And then eventually it was sold. And Camco got split up, and hence you'll now, the story for the lug will now transition in. When Camco was sold, there were two companies, basically, that got to purchase it. And the folks at Hoshino, which is Tama, they purchased the name, Camco, and the rights to the bass drum pedal. And my friend Don Lombardi, who had started DW, bought the rights and got to own the lug. So the Camco...
That's kind of a funny story, how the company...
Yeah, so the George Way slash Camco, that lug became the DW lug.
And this is why you don't see Camco drums anymore.
Right, because Tama, and Tama for a little while did reissue Camco drums.
See that
drums.
Elvin Jones style kit?
Yep, they did reissue Camco drums, and what they did was they took the aristocrat lug, the round aristocrat lug, and made it a little different with like a little extra piece on top. But those drums were not the same quality. Perspective.
I guess they probably did that because DW
DW owned the lug. So, that Camco under Tama didn't last very long, and Hoshino Tama, for whatever reason, has never used the Camco name again. So it is what it is. They did reissue the bass drum pedal at one point. It's a very nice pedal. So that little piece of lineage I thought was important to trace through Leedy to George Way to Camco and then to DW. DW falls a little bit outside today's conversation because we're really talking about the companies that were the dominant brands up through and into the 70s. And, of course, DW didn't really get started until the 70s.
Right.
Great drums, great people. I love them to death, but just a little bit outside of today's conversation. And then we probably should take it to the last two.
I've got there's the last two, and then I have some kind of over-encompassing questions that kind of encompass everything. But, yeah, the next one, we're going to talk about Rogers a little bit, which is, I mean, that went from when you were young, that's pretty much been your favorite company.
it's really hard to pick a favorite because I can look at each one of these companies and say there are things within each one of them, especially Ludwig, especially Slingerland, Camco, Rogers, and Gretsch, which we'll talk about next. There are things there that I love tremendously from each one of them. But Rogers was kind of near and dear to my heart. Rogers started in basically Cleveland, Ohio. And Joe Thompson was a great inventor. Ben Strauss was a great marketing guy. And those guys really built superb instruments. The stuff that came out in the 50s was great, but they really hit their stride right around 1963-64. They had guys like Buddy Rich, Louis Belson playing their drums.
Did Buddy Rich go from Ludwig straight to Rogers? There was a Slingerland in there for a minute.
He went from Ludwig to Rogers, and after Rogers, he went to Slingerland.
I see.
But Rogers, and of course, Rogers did, right around 1960, introduce the Woodshell Dynasonic snare drum, which is one of my favorites of all time, which is sitting behind my kit over there and behind one of my other kits, one of the original ones. So Rogers was extremely innovative. When we talk about innovation, Rogers had the Dynasonic snare, which is unlike other snares because the snare wires on a regular drum get pulled up and they tend to choke if you're not careful. With a Dynasonic snare, you can't see it here, but the Dynasonic snare, there's a frame that the wires sit on, and then that frame...
If you hold it up, they'll be on. Yeah. I'll put a picture of that.
And that frame is under the bottom of the head. And what happens there is you raise that frame up with the tension knob, but in order to tighten the snares, there's a little knob right there. You turn that knob and it tightens the wires on the frame. So rather than the wires grabbing tighter against the bottom head, they just are tighter against the frame, and the frame just comes up and basically barely touches the bottom head. So the response is superb. And it was a very, very innovative design, but that's not the only innovative design. They created what's called Swivomatic hardware. It's a great version of hardware with a ball and socket design, and it was the first ball and socket design of its kind, and pretty much any hardware you see today that has a ball and socket type of design came from that.
Just copies. And then this old stuff, even though some people complain that it'll move a little bit because it's a little lighter duty, it's all made out of metal. So it's the new ones, you know, give it like 50 years and the plastic, it starts to fall apart. But these old ones, a lot of the time, they still work after
the stuff's
50
great.
Years.
And they had a very innovative design for the brackets that held the tom holders that held the cymbal arms, bass drum spurs. They did a tremendous job, but more importantly than that, those are hardware innovations. The shells were incredible. The maple shells, 45 edges, they sounded phenomenally good. The fit and finish was great. Rogers was really like the Rolls-Royce of drums during that era from about, I'd call it 63 till about 69. Rogers changed hands, and like many companies, they were acquired. CBS had acquired Fender at one point in time, and that was largely seen as a bad period for Fender because of quality issues. And at the same time, CBS also decided to acquire Rogers not too long after they acquired Fender. And so generally speaking, the highlight for Rogers quality would be from 63, in my opinion, till about 69. Things changed dramatically after that.
Another note about Rogers innovation, that they were really one of the first drum companies, if not the first, to use sharper bearing edges on the drums. Because if you look at the old B&B lug stuff, that stuff is very flat. Yeah. But I've seen diagrams where they actually would have each drum would actually have a slightly different kind of angle on the edges. If you look at some of the Rogers books, and that's kind of an interesting innovation. Because I can't really think of another company that had a shell with a sharp bearing edge before Rogers.
Yeah,
that was 64 they started doing that, I think?
Rogers started that around 63, 64.
Right when the new lug started.
When they went to the beaver tail lug, the beaver tail design versus...
That's huge.
Design.
I mean, all modern drums have sharp edges now.
But that is true, because Ludwig didn't really go to a 45-degree edge until right around 1970, 71.
Yeah.
Slingerland didn't do a sharper edge till the late 70s when they went to the 5-ply shell. So, it was a different animal. Yeah. It definitely was. And the drums sounded great. They looked great. The fit finish was superb. And the technology was incredible. They were really the Rolls-Royce of drums in the 60s. Segue to our other favorite.
Your phone's going off there.
Yeah, that's all right. I'm just looking at my timer here. My other favorite is Gretsch. And the Gretsch company goes back a long, long, long time. You're talking about in the 60s, this is where Gretsch really was really, really prominent with a niche, the jazz players. And the things people liked about Gretsch drums, and this is where it's a little bit different. Gretsch is the only other example of a different kind of a bearing edge. if you think about this, we were talking about Ludwig and Slingerland with the three-ply shells that had reinforcement rings and rounded bearing edges. Gretsch had originally a three-ply shell in the 50s with a reverse round overbearing edge.
You're talking about the old ones that had reinforcement hoops on them?
Well, no, just I'm talking about just
Ludwig
and Slingerland had three-ply with reinforcement rings and rounded edges. When you got to Gretsch had a three-ply shell in the 50s with kind of a reverse round over edge, but in the late 50s when they went to a six-ply shell, they were their maple gumwood shell, when they went to that shell, that had a 30-degree edge. And so that's not a 45, but it's a 30-degree edge, so it's a little sharper.
Yeah, and an interesting thing about Gretsch, on the toms, and this is also true for the three-ply, and there's a couple things, maple, poplar, maple on all the drums.
Well, that was in the 50s.
But even in the 50s, the toms, they retained that reverse roundover edge, which is a lot like the old Chinese toms. That's kind of what they were going for.
Yeah.
But then on the snare and the bass drum, then the edge is the sharper edge, the 30-degree edge.
Yeah. Gretsch used to use, again, in that later 50s in through the 60s, it was a die-cast heavy, thicker rim. So the die-cast rim is going to take some overtones out. The six-ply shell was fairly thin but cross, laminated. So each one of the plies, the seam didn't fall in one place. The seams were staggered. So the shell was very strong without reinforcement.
There are pictures of like two guys standing
on the
one
shell.
Not even built out, just the shell. I think it would break. But.
I don't know. there was no Photoshop back then, so I don't know.
Yeah, who knows?
Maybe it was right. But you could, so you got a sharper sound. But the die-cast, heavy die-cast rims take some overtones out. So Gretsch was extremely popular during the 60s with jazz players. And the combination that those guys loved most was generally an 8x12, a 14-14 floor, a 20-inch bass, or an 18-inch bass. And the reason most guys got 18s wasn't because they liked the sound better. It was because in New York City, you could get an 18-inch bass drum in the trunk of a cab, and those guys were gigging 2-3 times a day sometimes, whether it was a studio session or a club date, and you could fit it in the cab.
Yeah.
So, but you start looking at the people who were playing Gretsch drums during that era, and you got Elvin Jones, you got Art Blakey, you got Philly Joe Jones, as time went on, you got Elvin, you got Tony Williams, you got incredible guys. Art Taylor was a player. There were so many jazz guys, Max Roach, that would just love the drums to bits. There used to be a comment that the Gretsch snare drums were a little boxy sounding at that point in time, and some of that is true.
Yeah, they have an odd thing about Gretsch snare drums. They have a huge snare bed.
Really huge,
enormous
snare bed.
And that might have been because of that 52-strand snare wire.
Yeah, 42. Yeah, at one point.
I wonder when that was invented. That probably 60s.
My own personal opinion is the 42-strand wire isn't necessary. It probably was necessary on those drums because the bed was so wide that you needed it. All he needed to do was not have as much wide a bed. But guys played the Gretsch drums. They loved the way they sounded. I mean, listen to Art Blakey. His snare drum sounds fine. Listen to Max Roach. His snare sounds fine. The kit sounds great. So
nice, punchy, kind of direct tone.
Yeah. They were very pure,
yeah,
very musical drums. And if you think about it, if you're playing in a jazz setting, it's generally an acoustic trio, quartet, quintet, pick a number. Yeah. You got piano-based drums, one, two, or three horns, and generally in that environment, the drums blended beautifully, the sound was pure, and they dialed up, tuned in easily. So they were wonderful drums, still are today, and the beauty of Gretsch is that Gretsch is the only company that still exists. Ludwig exists, but it's not owned by the family. It's the only company that's, and Rogers does too, but not by the families. Gretsch is the only company that's still family owned. And thanks goes to Fred Gretsch for that. And I remind people of that every time that I see them. There was Fred bought that business back. The business had been sold, and he bought the business back from when Baldwin owned it. He bought the business back. And I give him great credit for that, and he has always kept it family owned.
So when did Baldwin own it? I mean, it doesn't have to be exact.
I think
dates,
it was 80. I don't know. I'm getting old. My brain doesn't work perfectly. I think it was 85.
85. Yeah.
I'd have to go look.
So this is before the they got involved with KMC. and then
oh
and
yeah, that's long, long.
There was maybe a short period in between. Yeah, in,
I mean,
interim.
Gretsch, you know, Fred bought the company back, and I'm so thankful that he did, and still owns it today. And then the company distribution, after a while, distribution for Gretsch was done through KMC Music, and then most recently, and maybe it's like 6 years ago now. I think it's 6 years ago. KMC was purchased by Fender, and then Fender sold KMC Music. And in that whole process, our friends at DW purchased the KMC business that included the distribution of Gretsch. So
Fred still owns the name, but it's distributed by...
Fred still owns the company, and DW now controls... My good friend Paul Cooper has run that factory for about 20 years, and he's great. He's
yeah, the we best. Love working with him.
He's the best, I'll tell you. And
I'll do a podcast with him someday.
Yeah,
if I could ever get down there.
He'd love to do it. But so the Gretsch drums are still made in original South Carolina, and Paul and his team make the drums. The folks at DW do all distribution, but they also are responsible for that manufacturing. That whole manufacturing operation reports up to them. And they've done an incredible, fabulous job with it, and the drums are terrific. I mean, we sell tons of that stuff. So
yeah, we had so much Shellbank just recently, and it's actually, I mean, it's like half gone now. Yeah, that stuff.
Yeah,
just
I mean,
moved,
we had
which
I don't
is
know
great.
300 drums, something like that.
Yeah.
So wonderful.
So we've covered most of the main brands.
Yes.
Just real quick, I wanted to just do a quick nod to some of the smaller companies, just so that we know.
Okay.
That we know that we're so there's Fibes.
My yeah. Yes, and I
just
didn't
real
bring,
quick, you know,
I didn't bring them up here. Thank you. I didn't bring them up here because they weren't a major, but they were at least as significant. I would say at least as significant as Camco. I'm a huge fan of the Fibes drums, especially the fiberglass shell. Even their acrylic shell is fine, but the fiberglass shell is incredible. And Buddy Rich played a Fibes chrome over fiberglass snare through his Slingerland days, and
that was built out to look like a Slingerland.
No, 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 no. He's just he just played
oh, Fibes. Fibes lugs on
yeah,
there.
He just played a Fibes snare.
Was Slingerland okay with that?
But he said, this is the snare drum I'm going to play. When you make one this good, I'll play yours.
So they said, okay.
there were some other people who were Slingerland artists. Jay Canna was a Slingerland artist. Jay Canna was a very, very great big band drummer, show drummer, back when they had bands playing for in the studios for TV and radio shows and things like that. Merv Griffin show, all those they had house bands for those TV shows. He was very, very busy with that.
I've
he
heard
was
him
a Slingerland
before.
Artist.
Yeah, I don't know much about him, but I've heard
and
him.
And he had Bob Grosso at Fibes build him a Fibes snare drum covered with a veneer and built with Slingerland hardware so he could play it in a Slingerland.
I knew that happened somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
Somebody
yeah.
did that.
Yeah, and there were some other people who had that done, too. Fibes was great. I love him, and I have a huge Fibes collection. That's a topic in and of itself for another time.
But then there's maybe Zickos that with
Zickos.
We got a kit back there.
Yeah, I got another one. Yeah. Zickos was kind of a crazy company. Acrylic drums, and they sounded great. And all I remember once, and I'll have to do a separate thing on this, but there was a Zickos drum that had a regular head on top, and on the bottom it had something that. And I'm young. I'm like, I don't know, 21 when I'm looking at this, traveling on the road. And it looked like almost the thing of like a practice pad on the bottom or something. It was weird. And the shell was a fiberglass shell, and it came down, and it curved at the bottom, and then this thing was on there. It was really weird. And I said, this has got to sound like garbage. And I played on them in a music store, and it was just incredible. Incredible. So I finally, and they only made like a dozen of these kits because they were really weird. But it sounded great. And I found a used one once, and I finally bought it. It's in the back. I need to restore it, and one of these days I will, and we'll do a little Zickos video. But they were interesting. They had some cool stuff.
Yeah, definitely.
They were American company, just like Fibes.
There
yeah.
are other companies like Wolf or like, but those ones we don't do a lot with.
Yeah,
but
they're worth, and that you stuff know, all kind of goes back to
yeah. There a lot of our less expensive drums that
yeah. There were well George Stone. You know, you can start going back to
Noble and Cooley. That's another
the
company.
Early 19. Noble and Cooley started making toy drums and field drums.
At one point, yeah, they do make good.
No,
solid
they make great
drums,
stuff.
Though, yeah.
I'm just saying that's part of what their business model was.
Yeah.
And things like George Stone, and there are other companies that made the George Stone Master Model Snare is a great instrument. But those were like kind of around that early 1900s. There were a lot of different companies that were really kind of like just little niche boutique-y shops that some of them lasted longer than others. None of them ran the gamut like these companies.
And they didn't have any real like, you know, terrific innovations. So I wanted to talk a little bit about just each company, kind of go down the line and talk about the innovations that each one did, because one of the cool things that I really think, one of the things that I think is just really amazing about the early American drum companies is just that each one kind of had their own thing. They weren't copying other brands. They had their own sound, and they're very like, if you gave me a blind test and you gave me each of these drum sets from the 60s or 50s, mm-hmm. I just might be able to get, you know, maybe 75-80% of them right on. That's a blind test, and I think with modern drums that would be really difficult to do, because a lot of the times the modern companies they offer a little bit of everything, but each one of these companies they had their own sound and their own innovation. So maybe, do you want to start at the top of the list or the bottom of the list?
Well, we'll start at the top of the list. I mean, when I think of Ludwig, the first thing that comes to mind is metal shell snare drums. Ludwig ruled the roost.
Especially in America. Maybe they were doing it overseas, but
yeah, but I'm talking about here. We're talking about American companies, and Ludwig with their metal shell snare drum starting in the 20s, right on through to the Supraphonic 400. I mean, I think Ludwig, everything else they do is great, but I think metal shell snares, Ludwig was the winner.
Yeah, if you've never played a 20s or 30s metal Ludwig snare drum, you really should try
great.
It out. They're, in my opinion, they're the best snare drums ever made. They're almost all made out of brass, like even the hoops. Sometimes even the tension rods are made out of brass.
Fabulous stuff.
A lot of times they're steel, but... And then so...
Slingerland?
If we had... Remember, don't think about hoops, think about everything.
Yeah, no, yeah. Slingerland, I think, you know, thanks to Gene Krupa and Slingerland for, you know, tunable tom-toms.
And then there's also the Stick Saver hoops. They invented those.
Yes, they did.
That's
which
a
is instead of a triple flange hoop where the top flange bends outward for rim shots, Slingerland Stick Saver hoop bends inward, which,
right.
in my personal opinion, is a much easier rim to execute rim shots on.
Yeah.
So I actually love that rim myself.
And then the early ones were even chrome over brass, and those are...
Oh, yeah. That was... Yeah.
Some. I know Peter Erskine likes those because his signature Thomas snare drum has brass Stick Saver hoops.
Stick Saver style,
There's no chrome on them, but they're very cool.
And then, you know, Leedy had some very innovative strainer mechanisms, and their metal drums
were... What about
were
single ply?
Great, and their single ply was single ply was a good drum. So a Leedy single ply drum with one of their many innovative strainers, that would be their forte. Yes.
And then of course there's the slightly smaller shell, which
the floating head, design. That was an innovation there.
So they definitely had many of those. Oh, and then we can't forget about Ludwig, the bass drum pedal.
Oh, of course. Well, of course. Yeah, I'm thinking more in terms of the physical drums themselves, but yeah,
they invented
the bass drum pedal. Ludwig is the winner for that. And George, get down to George Way. I said thank you for the Aristocrat lug,
sure.
Which then became the Camco lug. And if you talk about Camco, I think Camco, those shells and those drums are some of the best sounding for jazz drums. They're some of the best sounding drums I've ever played in my life. They've got brass hoops, the early Oaklawn drums, beautiful shells. The hardware is beautiful. The drums really sing. They're incredible instruments.
Right. Oh, and then one last thing about Ludwig. Ludwig did a lot. Whether it was Ludwig or WFL, I'm pretty sure it was one of those two that were the first to use triple flange hoops. Because I know Rogers used them early, but I'm pretty sure WFL used them before Rogers.
Could be.
I mean, yeah, so that's yet another.
But yes.
Those are those old, beautiful brass ones.
Yeah.
But then on to Rogers, I mean, they invented
Rogers,
a ton
of
stuff.
The Dynasonic snare drum, the Swivomatic hardware, and setting the standard for fit and finish, and I would argue sound during the 60s, they had it nailed. And you get down to Gretsch, and you go to Gretsch, you go, that's the jazz player's number one choice.
Well, a big thing about Gretsch, too, they were the first company that made shells that were cross-laminated, even if you count the three-ply ones, without reinforcement hoops.
Yeah.
So that's what I think what gives you a little bit of that direct tone.
Yep.
So with Gretsch, you got no reinforcement hoops, thicker shells, which in the between the 70s and 80s, that's what everybody did.
Yeah, and the cross-lamination was made a very strong shell. It didn't have to be particularly thick, but it was very strong, and because it wasn't terribly thick, it was nicely resonant. So, yeah, I mean...
And then, of course, die-cast tubes.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, those are some bullet points on each one of those.
And it's just really cool because if you think about all those individual things... Even in like a blind test, I think if you really think hard, you could differentiate all these different kits,
yep.
one to another. And then just a couple last final questions here. So when it comes to like collectability in the modern market, when you're talking about, you know, 70s and before drums,
yep.
You want to go down the list and talk about what you think is maybe the most collectible now, where it's come from, and then where it's going to go in the future.
Yeah. It's easier to start with lowest demand as a collector piece. That's the easiest place to start. And George Way and Leedy have the lowest demand as collector pieces. And one of the simple reasons behind that is just because those two companies weren't as relevant for as long. So the generations of people who remember that as being relevant, it's pretty small. It's guys my age or older, and generally older than me, who remember Leedy when Leedy was a vibrant company, and remember George Way even.
The Leedy age ended in the 50s.
Well, it was absorbed by C.G. Kahn, and then it was sold to Slingerland in the late 50s.
That is the Slinger Leedy badge, I believe, right?
Yes.
So this is an example of a Leedy drum.
Made during the Slingerland ownership era.
It has those Slingerland hoops. That's kind of I put it up just because I love that.
Oh, yeah,
finish.
Capri Pearl. It's very cool, great.
Very rare finish.
So those two have the least demand. This has nothing to do with how good the drums are. I'm just talking about with collectors. When you look at Camco and Rogers are both very collectible and very much in demand.
Yeah, Camco especially, there's just so few of them out there. And I think DW has really kind of preserved their legacy, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, oh, for sure.
Because people see them and they see that.
DW has made an exact and perfect replica of the Camco LA shell with their new Santa Monica series, and the drums are incredible.
Yeah.
Slingerland's a little soft right now, but I love the drums. They're great drums, and I think you will see a big resurgence in Slingerland now that my friends at DW purchased the Slingerland name from Gibson.
There's a lot of them out there.
Yeah.
That's the thing about Slingerland.
And they are great instruments, and I think what you will find is that as things roll forward with the folks at DW, Don Lombardi is a very big fan of that brand and will want to do right by it, and I think you'll see a resurgence in that. Ludwig is still hot and heavy, major, major collectible piece, not only because of the Ringo Beatles fans, but also because if you think about Ludwig and you think about classic rock in the 60s, it's Ludwig drums. Ludwig.
Yeah, they really...
And Slingerland too, but really Ludwig drums.
After
Mitchell,
Ringo, they took the reins.
Ringo, Ginger Baker, John Bonham, you know, you start looking at those names and there's no question. And beyond that era, even into the 70s and beyond. So that's always heavily collectible. And Gretsch, heavy, heavy, heavy collectible, especially the 12, 14, 18 matching snare round badge era bop kits. Even the 12, 14, 20 kits with matching snare, the jazz players love them.
Yeah.
The vintage kits are in high demand. And
I don't think that'll ever go away because they just have that from the jazz era in New York City.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's never going to happen again. So
there's always going to be a pocket of people who are jazz fans and fans of the sound that was created during that era. And the drum sound during that era was created on Gretsch drums.
Yeah.
Can't much beat that.
Yeah.
So, I think we covered it.
I think we covered just about everything. I'm sure, you know, there are other companies out there that were around, but I think we got at least the major ones and then the ones that we deal with, even the smaller ones.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know.
We'll do separate individual segments. So we'll spend more time. We do Ludwig. We'll spend more time on Ludwig, and we'll talk more about different models and drums they made.
Each one of these companies, you could probably spend 6 hours on talking about.
I mean, my buddy
throughout
Rob Cook.
The eras. Yeah.
Rob Cook, I mean, you know. Yeah. This is the Slingerland book. It's a whole book. I mean, he
have it at the shop if you want to buy a copy.
He did the Rogers book. He did the Leedy book. you know, I mean, the Gretsch book, there's so much to tell. There's so much history there. It's great. So we will do individual segments on these. So then you can, if you're in your car, you just want to listen to a little bit about Ludwig history, you can put the earbuds in if you're sitting around and listen to our podcast, and we'll take you through each one of these companies. And we will take you through some of the lesser ones, lesser only in popularity, like Fives.
Sure.
We'll do a thing on Fives, too, and we'll cover that.
Right. So, yeah, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you guys next time.
All right. Thank you.